I want to say that it's my pleasure, my distinct honor to be able to be here with you this weekend. I have known about this lectureship and, of course, the congregation here for quite some time because we have some friends that we have in common. Al and Rhonda Washington, two of my good friends that still reside nearby in Austin. Of course, Josh Blackmer and his family are here from our neck of the woods, and now we're very glad to have Troy and Andrea with us. And so I'm glad to come and get a chance to visit with all of you and to, in some sense, shrink the congregations and the brotherhood, because every time I get to meet brethren from other places, I'm always thinking about how great the church is as a family. And I get to meet people that I've never laid eyes on before, but we have this instant connection that makes us matter to each other. And so I am grateful to be here with you this week. I'm going to stand up here because tonight I'm going to try and use PowerPoint. And I like having this little screen so I can see what I'm doing right and wrong. I will tell you in advance, I do not do this electronic thing very often. If I am electrocuted suddenly, I would be appreciative if you would call 911 on my behalf. I promise to thank you when I come to consciousness or when you get up there too. So, all right. I want to talk with us tonight in somewhat of a conversational tone, though I'm up here. I want to talk about a phenomenon that I believe is at work in all of human history. And it is a phenomenon that is unfortunately destructive, and yet one that is also possible to remedy and to overcome. We're talking this evening about the topic of walking by God's rule. And as we talk about this in three different stages, I want to begin by acknowledging that this phenomenon in all of human history, it is not a factor of just the United States, it is not just a factor of the 21st century. We are talking about a challenge that extends throughout the length and breadth of human history. When we talk about walking by God's rule, we have to acknowledge at the same time that there are people who challenge that idea, the idea of submitting to that which God would have us to do. And this is a problem that dates all the way back to the beginning of time. I know the children have gone off to their particular classes. I think the structure that you have here is tremendous. But if we brought the children in here, they could tell us about the early affairs with Adam and Eve found in Genesis chapter 3. You might be able to talk to us or even recite those particular verses yourself. But I do want to point to these, Genesis chapter 3, verses 1 through 5, because the very heart of the challenge that we speak about this evening is contained right there in that passage. In Genesis chapter 3, in verse number 1, that subtle serpent speaks to the woman and he says, "Yea, hath God said, you shall not eat of every tree of the garden." And he's all automatically slandering God and his goodness. The woman speaks up in verse number 2 and says, "We may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden. But of the fruit of the tree that is in the midst of the garden, God hath said, you shall not eat of it, neither shall you touch it, lest you die." And when she makes this response, this is what Satan says back. He says, "You shall not surely die, for God doth know that in the day that you eat thereof, then your eyes shall be opened, and you shall be like God, knowing good and evil." The key in this, the mature observation in this entire discussion, is to notice the promise, false but presented promise, that Adam and Eve, by indulging in this act, can in some way elevate themselves that they may be on par with God. Satan wants you and me and every person to think that God is attempting, like a tyrant, to keep us under his thumb. That all of the requirements, the advice, the counsel, the direction for life that he gives us is nothing more than an effort to reduce our human potential and to keep us from reaching up to the heights we might otherwise attain. And so what Satan is attempting to do is to make Adam and Eve the masters of their own destiny. They are going to be their own gods. And that is, in essence, the challenge that stands before all of humanity. Whether to acknowledge the true maker, creator, and sovereign, or to acknowledge ourselves, someone, or something else in his stead. If we look ahead in history, I'll tell you that this problem continues, of course. In Exodus chapter 20, we hear God speaking from the top of the mountain to the Israelites gathered at the foot below. And as he lists those particular commandments, this one in chapter 20 and verse 7 is the one that we ought to see. He speaks there and says, "Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless that taketh his name in vain." How have you always understood that phrase? What has that always meant to you? I always thought and read this as God prohibiting any empty or profane usage of his name, that someone might swear by his name falsely or lightly, or even that someone may profane his name. And we think about cursing, very, very prevalent, I'm sorry to say, in our culture. I admit that that is a very reasonable understanding of this. There's another reasonable understanding. Have you ever thought that this could be God's prohibition against an individual taking the name of Jehovah or God and pulling it into themselves and applying that name to themselves as though they could stand in his place and be the arbiters of their own destiny, the masters of their own lives? That would be empty in effort, but it certainly would amount to insurrection and rebellion. Ladies and gentlemen, what we are talking about is not, however, something that is stuck back in the recesses of time. When I was preparing to go to preaching school myself, as that summer was passing quickly, my wife and I were already living in the nearby area, and so I got a temporary job working in a lumberyard. And while I'm working there in the lumberyard, waiting for school to arrive, the time to arrive, I was working and one of my co-workers there asked me about the church that I attended. They knew I was a short-timer. And he asked me and he said, "This church that you go to, does it let you drink?" He said, "Because I can't go to a church anywhere that won't let me have a beer and drink." You realize how common that type of expression is, or that attitude? And yet it's the individual saying that I will do this in the name of Christ or in the name of God so long as it meets my expectations, my standards, my aims. That is the person lifting themselves up so that they would be God. Brethren, I really believe that many people would choose to become Christians if God would let them dictate the terms by which they became a Christian. I believe that many people would worship him as long as God allowed them the liberty or the freedom to choose to worship however they desired. If God let people set the terms, who would say no? The problem is that perpetrates and promotes the same lie that the serpent spoke to Eve that was her undoing, the undoing of her husband Adam, and has had all of these long-lasting consequences in the human world. It is a lie. Because you and I are not capable, not fitted, not expected to provide the directives, the rule, the plan for our own living. It's not within us. That's not a failing on our part. That is an acknowledgement of our own limitations. And it's a fair acknowledgement. I'm reminded of the words of the writer in Psalm 119 and verse 133. The writer there simply said, "Order my steps in thy word, and let not any iniquity have dominion over me." What did the writer say? Except, I'm not qualified to provide the rule for living that would follow, that I would follow and follow successfully. I need God, you to step forward to promote what steps I follow in my life so that I meet with success. I don't fall into the problems. I don't fall into the suffering and the sin that has so often beset humanity. That's all that that means. If we think we're selling ourselves too short, we're talking about the choices that we might make in terms of our relationship to God, our relationship to other human beings, the moral decisions, the religious decisions that we have to make. And someone might say, "Rick, you are selling humanity short. We can do better, and God ought to give us the freedom to go out and do." Really? And I suppose we're also very good at banking and investments and AIG and government bailouts and difficulties and problems that are nothing more than the fact that we don't always make the right choices, even if we know what they are, and you and I cannot see and master the future. We are not God. But we often set ourselves, we the human race, often set ourselves up as though we were. In point of fact, you and I are created with a purpose. It is expressed in Ephesians chapter 1 multiple times. Our goal in life, our purpose for being, is to be for the praise of His glory, which means that our lives have to be oriented properly toward heaven. Our text for this evening, that is the basic idea, comes from this passage, which is Philippians chapter 3, especially verses 15 through 17. Paul speaks there and he says, "Let us therefore, as many as be perfect, be thus minded. And if in anything you be otherwise minded, God shall reveal even this unto you. Nevertheless, whereto we have already attained, let us walk by the same rule, let us mind the same thing. Brethren, be followers together of me, and mark them which walk, so as you have us for an example." Earlier in this chapter, Paul has said that he had been born into a Jewish family. He had been given a great pedigree that he could not choose for himself. He could say, however, that concerning the law of Moses, he was very zealous. He pursued the law through the sect known as the Pharisees. In his choices and choice-making, Paul could say, "I have striven to do these things." But when he came into contact with the resurrected Christ, all of that lost all of its meaning. He says, "I count all of this but dung for the excellency of the knowledge of Christ." That's why, as he continues through, he says, "Leaving those things which are behind," he says, "I don't want to pick up my past and surrender Christ. I want to be a follower, a disciple of Jesus." And that leads into this passage where he says there is a right way to walk as a disciple of Jesus Christ. There is a rule to follow that characterizes all the faithful children of God, the disciples of Christ. Imagine, if you will, and I know we have some here who have a background in the military. Imagine all of the people of the Lord's church walking in step together by the same rule, the same guide, the same expectations and plans. What a tremendous force we would be for good in spreading the kingdom of Christ. That is the rule that Paul is asking his readers to acknowledge and to follow. It is a standard of expectation for life. Now, the reason Paul has to hold this up and ask that people follow it is because he knows very well that there are those who don't and who won't. Oftentimes, unfortunately, even associated with the name Christ and Christianity. Just past these verses, he mentions those who are enemies of the cross. Brethren, there are a lot of names that I could be called, a lot of names and designations I might wear, but I don't know how you get one worse than enemy of the cross. In all of the descriptions that he lists, they're selfish descriptions. People who are only concerned with what they want. Doesn't that sound like the elements of the past I've already cited? Or my coworker in the lumberyard? Or others with whom you have spoken as well? This is all a repeat of the Garden of Eden. How about if we look back to the days of the Israelites in Judges chapter 17? Judges, by the way, is a terrible book in some ways. It's great because it shows greatness of God, but it also shows the failings of human beings who say, "I don't have to listen, I want to do my own thing." The problem is the hearts of the people don't look to God and acknowledge the need for His leadership. So, Judges chapter 17 and verse 6. "In those days there was no king in Israel, and here is our problem. Every man did that which was right in his own sight." I say our problem, that's the perennial, persistent challenge that began in the garden. Every man did that which was right where? How about in his own eyes? No one would judge you, no one would critique you, you wouldn't critique me, because we would all be simply considered whatever we want, and that's acceptable. Perhaps the only complaint would be if my practices infringed in some way on yours. And then it's just the two of us butting heads. That's the problem. And it wasn't confined just to that time and that group of people. How about Jesus in Matthew chapter 15 in his own day? He said, "These people draw near unto me with their mouth, they honor me with their lips, but their heart is far from me." The problem, in vain do they worship me, teaching for doctrines the commandments of men. That is exactly the problem. We may choose or claim to be religious. The people of that day did. They didn't shake their fist at God and say, "I'm an atheist." They didn't do that. But they simply took God out of the equation and inserted themselves onto the throne where only Jehovah deserves to be. And Jesus rebuked them for that behavior. We might think that sometimes this type of treatment, this type of rejection, takes the form of open rebellion. Maybe in a simple term, you and I would hear someone say it like this: "I know what Jesus said, but..." And then they proceed to tell you what they want to do. That is the same problem. It may just be couched in a softer conversation. That's all. But brethren, I would like to take a couple of moments tonight and talk about other ways. Ways that are perhaps a little more insidious, a little more sneaky, that this type of thinking makes its way into our world, and brethren, also into churches. I hope that you'll benefit from the brief expose that I would like to give, because I hope that it has value to helping us to realize the very air that we breathe in the society and culture that is around us. I want to begin with a figure named Soren Kierkegaard, a 19th century Danish theologian philosopher. And living as he did at a time of the Enlightenment, as it's called, when there is a great emphasis on science and mathematics, Soren Kierkegaard proposed that human thinking could be divided into two different parts. One part can use reason, logical deduction, thoughtful processes of elimination and affirmation. But there's another realm in which he says we can't use the machinery of coherent thought at all. We just have to speculate and even then have no certainty. Now look at the realm, what it includes when we talk of non-reason. This is the realm of meaning and values. That would be the realm of religion. And what he suggests is that you can't approach, I can't approach the topic of religion, the topic of the discussion of the value of human life, emotions like love and hatred and violence and all of these things, we cannot approach those with logical, clear, reasonable thought the way that we might approach the topics involving facts and data. You ever heard anybody say things like this? Because they say it all the time. What we mean is that if you have someone like James Clerk Maxwell, whom I had the chance to study, not with, but study. Maxwell proposes these four laws of electromagnetics, famous, change science. Here's one that we know perhaps even better: E still equals MC squared. And you know, no one stands up and disputes that. You go to your bank and you say, "No, 2 plus 2 doesn't equal 4, it's 5, and you owe me another dollar." No disputing that. But you see, Kierkegaard and all of the people who think like this would say, well, of course, we do use clear thought, reason, our rational thinking when we think about data. When you go into the science laboratory and run the experiment, you have to be able to prove 1, 2, 3 what's been done. There are things that are right and things that are wrong. This is a clerical error. But what about when we step out of the realm of facts and data, brethren? What about the world and its thought then? Maybe we step over to the world of art, things that have been acknowledged as true masterpieces of creativity and artistic prowess throughout the centuries. I love this painting by Michelangelo. Or maybe we look instead at this one that's so famous by Claude Monet. You may not like it, but that doesn't matter, because it's in the realm of meaning and values, and what you feel about it or think about it or respond to it, whatever way, doesn't matter. That's your choice. Maybe there are some things that you think are in fact, well, maybe ugly. That's okay. There's nothing wrong with that, right? What if we said that, however, when we started talking about the interrelations between people? How about the most tender pictures of a mother with a child? Well, that's okay. We certainly want people to feel that. But remember, we're talking now about areas where reason doesn't apply, meaning and value. So while we think to ourselves, I would like to rejoice over the beauty of this image, in this vein of thinking, there would be no room to criticize the very opposite that occurs in human history. The horrors, the violence, because in this realm of thinking, there are no morals, there are no absolutes. You can do and think what you want, and no one stands in a position to criticize, because we can't use logic, we can't use reasoning, and we certainly can't have any absolute standards. And those images represent the very real outcome of that type of thinking. I appreciate this quote by William Bennett, who was former Secretary of Education. And this is his observation. Not, I will say, from a religious point of view. He's certainly not a preacher. But he just observes how people think and how they act. For the first time, I think, people are really wondering if there is such a thing as truth. And we can certainly see how this would apply to the topic of what about a rule, right? He says, people aren't quite sure anymore what grounds there are for arguing why something is wrong. There's indifference. There's exhaustion. It's whatever. And that's often the attitude that people display. I remember reading in the Austin newspaper a few years ago. It was a quote. It was such a significant quote that it was put into these excerpts that come out in the Sunday paper. It was a professor of history in a college that said for the first time he had had a group of students come into his class, and as they talked about world history in the 20th century, they could not make themselves say that what Hitler and the Nazis did was wrong. The most that they could say was, I wouldn't do it. Now, who is the rule for right and wrong behavior in their thinking? And they will share that. And this is a contagious way of thinking. It is a communicable disease, and it affects the way people view their world. This is a picture of the main building at the University of Texas there in Austin where I live, and I've taken classes on this campus. I don't know that you're able to read it here on the front, but just above that lowest set of windows is a quote you'll probably recognize. You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. Does that surprise us to see that on a building at a state university? The University of Texas is secular. There is no religion department. They won't have one. There is no mixing of church and state in their way of thinking in that regard. So what they have done is they have taken this tremendous statement by Jesus from John 8. They have stripped it out of its context. They have emptied it of any meaning and then placed it on their building to say that they, as the university, are now the place to go to learn. But it's all secular learning. There's nothing there. Like Mr. Kierkegaard from some time ago, they excel in discussing the reason aspects of facts and data. But you cannot step onto that campus and to say that this action is right or that action is wrong or this action is right or that one wrong. Well, we can't say that there are any absolutes. This meaning or this phrase has been emptied. They have turned it completely secular. Well, what if we grow up in this soup of thinking? What if this is the way that we really view the world? What I'd like to talk with you about now is the consequences of Mr. Kierkegaard and his thinking. And I want to remind you once again just what he said. Non-reason. You can't argue or dispute over value, meanings, and religion. You can only dispute over whether 2 plus 2 is really 4. There is a phenomenon that I would like to inform you about that is moving in the last decade or two across not only America but around the world, and it is called the emerging church movement or the emergent church movement. And you'll notice the quote at the bottom, since times have changed, the church must follow the times and change. Nothing absolute. Notice how religion, again, lumped into that area of non-reason, no certainties or firm statements. Here are figures who are leading the way. Maybe these names mean something to you, maybe they don't. But I highlight Brian McLaren. We'll return to him in just a moment. But he is one of the leading figures in this type of thought. He is not a member of the Lord's Church, but that does not mean that he is not taking in some way the name of Christianity with him in his speeches and conversations. Here is the goal of this movement. See if these sound very similar to what we mentioned a moment ago. First of all, they say we have no foundation for any beliefs, therefore we cannot know absolute truth. Since we cannot know absolute truth, we can only experience what is true for our communities, which I presume means I couldn't say that Hitler was wrong. I can only say that in my community, that wouldn't go over very well. Anything goes, and everyone is their own king in their own eyes. Furthermore, they continue and say, since we cannot know absolute truth, we cannot be dogmatic about doctrine. Think about how that eviscerates or removes the possibility of talking about anything that is contained within the pages of this book in a productive and useful way. How about, since we cannot know absolute truth, we cannot be dogmatic about moral standards. Do you look at our nation's leaders and approve or disapprove on their lives, their choices, their work, and on what basis? And from this framework, within the context of Christianity, nominal Christianity, we can't say one is right and one is wrong. No longer people can stand up for the gospel and the principles that it teaches. We have had that taken away from us. Let me give you an example. Here is Tony Jones who says, we should stop looking for some objective truth that is available when we delve into the text of the Bible. That means that your Sunday morning teaching or your conversation with your neighbors, or if you are a more recent convert to the Lord's church, the conversation someone had with you was really not necessary at all. There's nothing left because there's nothing being held on to as certain, fixed, or sure. How about the next quote? And this is from our friend Brian McLaren. I hope the type is large enough to read. It says, I don't believe making disciples must equal making adherence to the Christian religion. It may be advisable in many, not all, circumstances to help people become followers of Jesus and to remain within their Buddhist, Hindu, or Jewish contexts. Rather than resolving the paradox via pronouncements on the eternal destiny of people more convinced by or loyal to other religions than ours, we should simply move on. We ought to help Buddhists, Muslims, Christians, and everyone else experience life to the full in the way of Jesus while learning it better myself. He says, I would gladly become one of them, whoever they are, to whatever degree I can, to embrace them, to join them, to enter into their world without judgment, but with saving love as mine has been entered into by the Lord. What he's just said is that Jesus is not the way, the truth, and the light, that Jesus is not the only name given under heaven whereby we must be saved. What he said is we can just have conversations about how they perceive their religious feelings and how we perceive ours. Ladies and gentlemen, that type of thinking operated in the days of the apostles. They could have left Jesus in heaven and had this good of a message. Jesus obviously came to change that. But look at the influence this has had on people's thinking, at least one individual's. Here is a blogger, someone who wrote a note on their webpage. He said, we cannot be sure that Christ ever claimed to be God or the Father. I personally follow Christ's message and call myself a Christian without believing that he was God. He was a spiritual man who had a simple message, which yet is the ultimate challenge for anyone to live by. Now, if you would like to have a conversation with him about whether or not Jesus really was God, what are you going to use? Because as far as he's concerned, and this type of thinking is concerned, every religious statement is relative. There are no absolutes. I like school. My kids ask me when I'm going to graduate. They ask me how school was today when they come home. There is a school that I've attended. I've taken classes there. I know people who have. I have had childhood friends who have gone and who have gained their education there. So to be able to point out what I'm about to show you is no joy whatsoever. But it is at least, I believe, a fair point of discussion on our topic about what rule we follow for life. This is a webpage from Abilene Christian University. It is a webpage announcing their upcoming speakers for the 2008 lectureship summit that was held just a couple of months ago. And of the three keynote speakers, the one that is on the top may be a familiar photograph to you. We saw it just about two or three slides ago. One of their three keynote speakers was Brian McLaren, not a member of the Lord's Church, does not believe there are any standards, there are any absolutes, would certainly not agree that there's any rule by which we ought to live and how we ought to walk. And yet, his topic is about retaining Christians for Christ. Why for Christ? Why not for Buddha? For him, it doesn't really matter. Brethren, what about the youth who attend this college and attend these types of lectures? I'm not anti-education. I'm pro-Christ and Christianity. And I'm for teaching truth and knowing that truth really does exist because Jesus has said that it does. And that the principles they reject are the very ones Jesus and his apostles upheld. Here's a statement that I thought was telling from 2001. I appreciate Brother Tom Holland referencing this when I read it. He said life, or the article said, life was nasty, brutish, and short 2,000 years ago, but the issues of the day were surprisingly modern. What that tells us, and it's a true assessment made by an uninspired person who simply saw reality, God doesn't care whether you drive a chariot or a Chrysler. God doesn't care whether you wear sandals or Nikes. But you and I do care about issues of deity, divinity, about our role before God. We care about how we ought to treat our husbands and our wives and our children. We care about whether right will prevail over wrong, good is championed over evil. That is at stake, and people wrestle with those issues today just like they did then. Absolute, universal problems need absolute, universal solutions. And that is exactly what Christ and his gospel represent. I'd like to talk about our reference a moment ago back to Philippians chapter 3 and verse 16. Paul said there is a rule that we ought to walk by and mind the same thing. That word rule is a great word. It's our word canon, or gives us our English word canon. A canon is something that is recognized as authoritative. Originally, the word may have been used about a measuring stick, a reed that could be used to measure how long something was and to know if it measured up or not. That's the way it's used in the book of Ezekiel. Well, some would look at this and say, well, such a canon, Rick, is oppressive. God is trying to keep us under his thumb. That's what Satan said, right? I'd like to propose that we look at it as a gift. It is God's way to show us how to live, how to make life as successful and prosperous as it can be while being his faithful children. And he gives us the insight we wouldn't already have on our own, we're not going to have on our own. And if anyone were a good student of history, that ought to be as clear as a bell. God has blessed us with the knowledge of right and wrong and with his message. I want to talk about the devotional writings of the Old Testament. When we read about these, it's not that they're so much involved in doctrine, as much as they are in calling the readers to think about their relationship with God and how that ought to manifest itself in their lives. It is material they are supposed to look at, to think about, and to ponder. For example, how about Psalm number 1? You remember how it begins? Blessed is the man that walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor standeth in the way of sinners, nor sitteth in the seat of the scornful. But his delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law doth he meditate day and night. That sounds like there's a rule or a standard. The benefit is found in the next verse when he says, he will be like a tree that is planted by rivers of water. His leaf will not wither, whatsoever he does will prosper. How about the other side of the coin? For the ungodly, it is not so. They're like the chaff, blown away, and you never see them again. What a great message to put right at the beginning of the Psalms. Because that prepares the heart of the reader to seek out that which God has had to say, to rejoice in having guidance, and to incorporate it into their living. That is the theme that we should pursue. How about Psalm number 19? It's a great psalm. If you haven't read it recently, I encourage you doing so. But Psalm number 19 speaks, and there the writer says, the law of the Lord, in verse 7, is perfect, converting the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. It's educational. He goes on in the next verse and he says, the statutes of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. What a great connection with our theme for this weekend. And then he goes further and says, the commandment of the Lord is pure. It enlightens the eyes. God helps us to open up and to see and to appreciate and understand. I was very sorry to hear about the circumstances in Pulaski, Tennessee, where Brother Sane works. Brother Sane is a very fine fellow, and I don't get to see him as often as I would like for our interaction. I was looking forward to it this weekend. But he had a responsibility there. I can appreciate that. At times like those where he will be or has been working this week and today, helping that family, I know people very often read the 23rd Psalm, still in the devotional material. The 23rd Psalm speaks, and yet I don't want us to become so, comfortable with it that we fail to hear the great strength that it relates. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. He restoreth my soul. Now watch this. He says, he leadeth me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Those pathways must then exist. He goes further and he says, yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. That guidance that God seeks to give is the key to succeeding in life. Look at how the next verse goes. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. Thou anointest my head with oil. My cup runneth over. Surely goodness and mercy will follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. It's made possible because we know who God is and because we follow His direction, not because, as these other figures have said, we have no insight. That doesn't answer it at all. And then I'd like to append this last reference, Ecclesiastes 12 and verse 13. Maybe you could quote this verse. It is a great one. And I'd like to show how it connects with our theme for this weekend. At the close of this great book, where Solomon details his pursuit of joy, happiness, peace, all these types of satisfactions, he finally arrives at the conclusion that they can't be had from material things. It's not something you impart to me and I impart to you. It is not humanly generated. This type of centeredness, joy, and peace really can only be had by the person who gives themselves to God. And so this 13th verse says, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. To fear, reverence God, that is the whole duty of man. Now, I've noted in the book, the word duty there is in italics, and they've supplied it, the translators, because they thought that it helped to make it more understandable. This is the whole duty of man. I think of the word duty, and I think of a responsibility. You stand to your duty post. I've got a duty to take care of, then I can go and I can relax. Rearing my children is a duty, a responsibility, and a valid one, but it'll come to an end at some point. They'll go off in theirs, and then I do what I want. That is not the nature of human living. There is no end to our responsibility and great blessing in honoring God with our whole existence. In our book, Philippians, this weekend, in chapter number 2, there is this great statement about Jesus that is found there. And being found in fashion as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. Those first couple of words, and being, could be accurately translated this way. Since he was found in fashion as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient all the way to death. That is a limit that is reached. At no point did he sell out and say, no, that's not what I want to do. Well, I was with you until you had something that I didn't choose to do. Or I was with you until it cost me something. That very wording says that Jesus went up to the extent of even losing his life and yet never turning his back on faithfulness to God. Even if it was a difficult death, he didn't pass in his sleep. Jesus, in coming in the flesh, showed us how we ought to live. And did that which is the human responsibility to do, which is to walk by the rule that God has established. That's why Jesus was sinless. He perfectly walked by that rule or upheld it in his life. Now, not only is God telling us then that that's what we ought to do, but here is his Son embodying it for us and showing us by example that is what we ought to do. I love the words that are found here in Hebrews chapter 5, verses 8 and 9. Though he were a son, yet learned he what? How could we learn obedience if there was nothing that we had to follow? No absolutes can entail no obedience. Jesus learned obedience by the things which he suffered, and being made perfect, he became the author of eternal salvation unto all of them that obey him. That's you and me. I want to walk after the footsteps of Christ. And I want all of us to cherish what it means to follow God's rules for our lives. And not to look at it as something that's onerous or odious, something that's hateful or ugly, because it isn't. As we close, I'd like for us to think about what it means to have a divine rule, because it ought to be appreciated for the gift that it is. Number one, it means joy in living wisely, and that's the great theme of the book of Philippians. Proverbs chapter 13 and verse 15 says, "The way of the transgressor is hard." All that means is someone who tries to live away from God suffers through life. Perhaps you've seen those individuals who've made such bad choices for so long through their lives that in a sense their sin and the results of it can be seen in their faces, in the way that they stoop or the burdens that they carry or the health that they have lost. That is the cost of walking without God. And yet, how about the proverb that says righteousness lifts up or exalts a nation? And it does to the individual as well. I hope we find real joy in being a Christian, and the joy that comes in sharing that message with other people, because the world around us needs it so very badly. Number two, I would encourage us to have confidence in living wisely. If I go and speak with someone and say, "This is not the direction we ought to go, this is," that is no arrogance, or should contain no arrogance on my part. I have not been wise enough to come up with the gospel or sharp enough to develop the plan of salvation. Paul said it this way, "If I boast, I boast in Christ." That's where all boasting ought to be. But that does not mean that I have to surrender the fact that Jesus did do something. He did teach something, and he did expect people hear and learn about his life and sacrifice. John would write in 1 John 5 and verse 13, "I've written these things that you may know that you have eternal life." Where does that knowledge come from except from the things that God has revealed to us so that we might have that type of insight? Why in the world would we throw that away and step back into a cloud of darkness and confusion? Number three, I appreciate the consistency that comes in living by God's rule. There's a great line that I read in N.B. Hardeman's sermon that I quoted in the manuscript, and I think it's great for this point. Because what he says is that when we go to God's rule and we read it, we follow it, and we live it, we are slaking our spiritual thirst from the very same fountain or source from which our forefathers, grandfathers, and on back slaked theirs as well. Brethren, if all of these changes and the loss of absolutes is really right, though how you could demonstrate that I don't know, what would that mean for our children's time and our grandchildren's time? We won't recognize their lives. We wouldn't recognize Christianity in their sight or in their lives, because what would we measure it by? The consistency to know that if Paul were to walk in the doors here, he would very well understand what we're doing and why, and could, I think and hope, agree with it if we do our business right. That consistency, how precious. And the last thing, the basis of living wisely. When I go to the end of my life and they have a tombstone and an epitaph written there, I don't want to have an epitaph that says, "He wished he got a mulligan." I'd like to know that I did it right the first time, that I followed the right leader, that I gave myself to the right master and became his disciple, which means that I am dependent upon God to provide me the right basis for living. Jesus said in Matthew chapter 24 and verse 35, "Heaven and earth, all of this will pass away." But the message that he gave, the words that he uttered and spoke, the guidance and the counsel he has given, this rule, it never passes away. It never becomes obsolete. It never is invalidated. It is always, always just what we need. And our Creator knows that. And that's why he's blessed us with it. Brethren, I remind us of the words of Paul. Let us, in all that we do, in all that we think, in all that we say, let us walk together by the same rule, the gospel of Jesus Christ, that has been such a blessing to so many generations through all of these years. May God bless us, each and every one, in pursuing the Lord's will in our lives. Thank you.